in particular, I want to welcome Ms. Cordelia Robertson from Legal Aid South Africa, and the man who created job opportunities for all of you by going to the Constitutional Court in the J case and cause all the problems that you have to solve today. And that is Mr. Monan Kalis on this side. So otherwise today we would be loitering in the streets unemployed because there would be nothing to do. So he has really helped us and created a job for us. So we'll hear more from him, I guess, in the course of the day. We will ask the legal aid team to make their presentation, and we'll engage. And then you remember yesterday we requested Mr. Bassett and his team to do a presentation on the proposed amendment of Section 57. And then we will give them an opportunity to do so. And for legal aid, you'll be hearing that for the first time. We'll give you an opportunity to make your input on that. So don't be frustrated, you'll have a chance. So all we need from you is to listen carefully and come back to us with your contribution. We also agreed that other presenters that came before us will be favored with a copy of that proposal so that they all can make their input. And then hopefully we can together move South Africa forward. Thank you very much. Ms. Cornelius Robertson, can I open the floor to you?
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. It is an honor to present you in Parliament today once again, and we'll be dealing with the submission of Legal Aid South Africa on the Criminal Law Sexual Offences and Related Matters Amendment Act. I'm not sure if all the members of the Honourable House have had a chance to read through our submission.
Just assume that they had the opportunity to read, but they didn't understand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Basically, if you look at clause 1, legal aid is no objection thereto. Clause 2, the clause brings about amendments as per section 15 of the Principal Act in terms based on the judgment of the TD basis, and there's no objection to this clause at all. It conforms to the judgment of the Constitutional Court as in hand it is in the best interest of the child. The effect of this clause will be to reduce the number of children who are prosecuted for their offence and will therefore lessen the demand for legal aid to be provided to these children accused, to these accused children. Clause 3 brings about the amendments of Section 16 of the Principal Act consequent on the judgment in the Hedda Bay case. Once again, legal aid has no objection to this clause. It conforms to the judgment of the Constitutional Court and is in the best interest of the child. The effect of the clause will be to reduce the number of children who are prosecuted for the offence and will therefore lessen the demand for legal aid to be provided to these child accused. Clause 4. This clause brings about the amendments to Section 46 of the Principal Act consequent of the judgment in J case. We have no objection to this clause. It confirms to the judgment of the Constitutional Court and is in the best interest of the child. There are no implications for legal aid essay with regards to the provision of legal aid. Clause 5. This clause brings about amendment to Section 47 of the Principal Act consequent on the judgment in the J case. We have no objection to this clause. It conforms to the judgment of the Constitutional Court and is in the best interest of the child. There are no implications for legal aid issue with regard to the provision of legal aid. Clause 6. This clause brings about amendment to Section 48 of the Principal Act consequent on the judgment in the J case. We have no objections to this clause. It conforms to the judgment of the Constitutional Court and is in the best interest of the child. There are no implications for legal aid with regards to the provision of legal aid. Clause 7. This brings about amendments to Section 50 of the Principal Act consequent on the judgment in the J case. We have no objections to the clause. It conforms to the judgment of the Constitutional Court and is in the best interest of the child. Insofar as policy is concerned, Legal Aid South Africa is currently required to provide representation to children in terms of Sections 82 and 83 of the Child Justice Act, 75 of 2008, where they are unrepresented. Therefore, such legal representation would be able to address the court on behalf of the child on the provisions of this clause. Legal Aid South Africa will therefore require no additional capacity as a result of the imposition of this clause. Our practitioner is also sufficiently skilled to be able to address the court in this regard. Clause 8. This clause amends Section 51, the Principal Act, so to make it possible for a person who was a child at the time of commission of the offence to apply to have his or her name removed from the register of sexual offenders. We have no objection to this clause. It conforms to the judgment of the Constitutional Court on the best interest of the child. Insofar as policy is concerned, Legal Aid South Africa generally does not provide legal representation for persons who are not detained, arrested, or sentenced. However, there are a limited number of exceptions to this general rule where legal representation is provided to a person who is not an accused or detained person in a criminal trial, such as Section 204 witness. We will, however, consider a revision of our policy to provide legal assistance to persons who are envisaged to be affected by this proposed amendment, which in this instance will be children. Clause 9. The provisions of this clause are necessary as the defence referred to Section 56(2)(b) of the Principal Act will now be incorporated in Section 16, C Clause 3. We have no objection to the amendment of Section 56, Subclause 2. Clause 10, this clause makes it possible for the Minister to make regulations regarding this procedure to be followed in terms of Clause 8. This is obviously essential. We have no objection to this clause. And those are the comments from Legal Aid South Africa. Thank you.
I think that's a you should have added a paragraph to say that Mr. Bashard and his team are very good lawyers, because what they drafted, they respond to the court very well. And thank you very much. Honorable members, can I open the floor for comments, contributions to the proposal?
We will come and appreciate the presentation.
Mrs. President, did you lobby these honorable members? Or is it because of your good work that they just agree and they don't want to open their mouth?
I think, Mr. Chief, that we just do good work here as you are aware. Thank you.
I can confirm that I visited your offices in Alexandria, and nobody knew who I was, but I found that everybody, including the cleaners, were so friendly, and I could see that there must be good leadership in the Legal Aid South Africa. I was very impressed, and you can inform that office that we are very impressed with the work that I do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will not only inform the office, but I will also inform our chairperson and our CEO and chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is it, may I also ask a question from Legal Aid, if, with your permission? Thank you. Chair, Clause 8, I think it is. Was it Clause 7? Just check. Clause 7, that's the provision that deals with the removal of a child's name from the register. Just like to remind members, there was a proposal from one of the NGOs and supported by others that clause should possibly be changed to place an onus on the prosecution to bring applications to the court to have the child's name included on the register, where the prosecution is of the view that that is necessary, so that not all children will automatically be included on the register, but only those that the prosecution thinks pose a danger in future. And in our responses to that proposal, the department doesn't have any objection to that, but the implications of that, because the proposal goes further and says once the prosecution makes an application to the court for that purpose, the child must be assessed at state expense. And I was wondering whether Legal Aid South Africa could deal with that aspect, because it's going to, if something like that is proceeded with, or even if this clause as it is proceeded with in the bill, there might be financial implications for Legal Aid South Africa. And I was wondering whether they are in a position, it might be difficult for them to answer that right now, but there will be financial implications affecting the budget of Legal Aid South Africa. Thank you very much.
Raising that, because when we deal with the criminals, there are no qualifications. The law obliges us to provide legal assistance. And we say that the children are our future. And the children cannot be employed and can be children of unemployed parents. They can be children of unknown parents. And now we must really have very, very sound reasons why the state should be prepared to provide everything for criminals and not for children. It may be something that you don't have an answer now, but it's a question that we'll have to engage with before we really finalize this act. Over to you, Ms. Brooks.
Once again, Ms. Chi, thank you. Ms. Chi, when we look at, for example, the criminal capacity of children under the age of 14, the state would normally have to prove that the child has got an issue of criminal capacity, so psychiatrist reports are obtained by the state to show that the child has an issue of criminal capacity. If we, Legal Aid South Africa, are defending that child and we do not agree with that particular report, or we want our own report, then we have run it by our experts, and we will then get an own psychiatrist to actually examine the child, do a consultation, etc., and also come up with a report. And I think in this instance it might be a very similar principle, that the state has the obligation to then get the initial report on the child before the child's name is brought, put on the sexual offenders register, and Legal Aid in defending the child will then possibly get an expert as well. So I think that at this stage would just be a comment from Legal Aid South Africa.
Take care of the issue.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Well, thanks very much, Zoe. That created a storm in a teacup. Mr. Bassett, we are in your hands.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. As I said yesterday, we were asked by this committee to come up with an option to try and address concerns that had been raised, and a document was distributed yesterday, just shortly before the committee adjourned, and I briefly said what the document was about. I'm going to ask Mr. Dupuy to take the committee through that document and perhaps to give a bit of history how it was developed. Mr. Dupuy, I'll also ask to perhaps give a short outline of how the law in this regard, dealing with statutory rape and the common law, how it has developed over years, because I think that history of the law will be of assistance to understand the law that we have at present on the statute in terms of the 2007 Act, and hopefully it also assists members in understanding the proposal, and I really say it's an option. Maybe I shouldn't use the word proposal. It's an option for the committee's consideration. Officially, the department's recommendation is still as contained in the bill, but this is an option for the committee to consider. Thank you.
Record. Tapos, what is the surprise distribution in this
person? His state law advisor works together with me in the Chief Directorate Legislative Development. So we as a team draft the legislation for the justice portfolio.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, good morning. Good morning to your members as well. I must immediately apologize. I was caught off guard, Chair. I thought there would be another presentation. So if you would allow me just to quickly start up my computer and then I would be able to address you. So if you would allow me just 2 minutes. I'm terribly sorry about that, Chair.
Some time for you because we knew we were taking you by surprise. Apply for a coffee break, it is approved.
Playing the ball today.
Two proposals. The one that the minimum of 12 should be reduced to 10 years, and also the other proposal would be that the possibility should be investigated of considering lifting the minimum age of 12 to 14. I'm mentioning this to you, Mr. Chair, because I would like to explain to you how our court processes went up to the stage where we reached yesterday, when we submitted the document to the committee as a proposal for the possible amendment of the provisions. Insofar as reducing the minimum of 12 to 10 years, we found that the arguments were sound, but we were concerned that a number of unintended consequences were not taken into consideration when that proposal was
made. Just for the benefit of those who were not here, just say what were those reasons for lowering from 12 to 10?
Indeed, Mr. Chair, the South African Catholic Bishops Conference argued in short that the 12 years, the minimum of 12 years, is not in line with the provisions of criminal capacity in the Child Justice Act. The argument was therefore that it should be lowered to 10. However, as I indicated, there is a number of unintended consequences, but I think the bench will take those over, and I'm just going to focus on one reason why we would not be in a position to support that proposal, and that is that the department is currently, as required in terms of the Child Justice Act, looking at the possibility of increasing the minimum criminal capacity age of 10 to a higher age. I can't foresee at this stage what the final recommendation would be, but our concern in that regard was that, and that report is, I think, nearly due to be submitted to Parliament. The Minister will submit that report and recommendations to Parliament, and if approved, then of course the minimum age of criminal capacity would increase. So in short, our argument was at this stage that it might be putting the cart before the horses at this stage to make a final decision with regard to lowering the minimum age of 12 in this act to 10, because there's a strong possibility that the criminal capacity age might be lifted, and that would once again put the act not in line with the Child Justice Act.
It's not final, but more or less to lift it what?
Our understanding is at least 12, Chief, or around about 12, but I wouldn't want to pre-dent. Thank you, Chief, so I am protected by Chief. Thank you, Chairperson. Mr. Chair, the second proposal, lifting the minimum age of 12 to 14, that proposal we didn't really oppose. We said that one would not necessarily have a problem with that, but the very first question was, what useful purpose will those provisions then serve if you reduce the protective age group 12 to 16 and up to 14, between 14 and 16? So the question was, will it not eventually be regarded as a nonsensical provision? So we reached the stage where we thought that we should start thinking about the request of the committee to come up with a possible proposal to address the concerns that have been expressed that the age of consent has been lowered in light of the Teddy Bear case. And that took us back to common law and to the 1957 Act. You will recall, Mr. Chairperson, that Section 14 of the 1957 Act dealt with certain offences being committed against children who are older than 12. We drew the connection between the 57 Act, Section 14, and the common law definition of a right. In terms of the common law, the definition of right was the unlawful and intentional sexual penetration of a woman without her consent. Together with that, one should also read the rule, the common law rule, that a female, a girl child under the age of 12, cannot consent. So we reached the conclusion that it was necessary for the legislature to fill a certain gap, and that gap was that if you prosecuted a person who had sexual intercourse with a girl under the age of 12, it was an automatic charge of rape. But if you had to prosecute a person who, for example, raped a 13 or a 14-year-old, then the case became different. Then the state had to prove the absence of consent, etc. And if you could not prove absence of consent, then of course you wouldn't have had a successful prosecution for rape. So the legislature decided to fill that gap. But the legislature did not decide to do anything about the common law rule of 12 years. That was left alone because that rule was well known and was no reason to amend that rule. So what the legislature did was to create these statutory offences and to place certain ages by determining that the person who commits an immoral act, for example, with a 16-year-old, is then guilty of contravening Section 14 of the Sexual Offences Act. What is very important, Mr. Chair, if you look at Section 14, nowhere in the section the word statutory right appears. It's just a matter of interest. And it's easy to explain to you why. We are of the considered opinion that the term statutory right was being used by authors of textbooks, for example, to explain the difference between the so-called common law right and what they then started to term as statutory right. That led us to the conclusion, Mr. Chair, that there is, strictly speaking, a natural consequence associated with the fact that the legislature in 57 had filled a gap which existed in the common law, which take into consideration that in 2007 the legislature repealed the common law insofar as sexual offences is concerned. So the question was raised whether sections 15 and 16 still serve a useful purpose. And that is why we recommended or the proposal indicates that if you amend Section 57 of the Act by stating it clear that there are certain parameters in terms of ages, then strictly speaking, there is no need to have those two provisions, namely Sections 15 and 16, in the Act. I'm just quickly going to, before we address the proposed amendments themselves, maybe just highlight the consequences for you insofar as the proposed amendments are concerned. They are actually under the paragraph headed introduction in the document that was handed to the committee members. We raised the question whether sections 15 and 16 should not be scrapped. Section 57 could then be amended in order to determine that children under the age of 16 years are unable to consent to sexual acts, but then a proviso should just be inserted to cater for the determination of the Constitutional Court in the Teddy Bear case. The consequences or the implications, Mr. Chair, of such an amendment is that a provision will be made for children under the age of 16 years in respect of normal settled behavior among peers, in line with the Teddy Bear case. The protection of a vulnerable group, namely children, will be extended to include children under the age of 16 years. It may also be considered that the strongest possible message will be sent to predatory adults who interfere with children under the age of 16 years to the extent that there will be only two crimes in respect of which they can be convicted, namely rape or sexual assault, and not be suffered statutory rape or statutory sexual assault anymore. And the penalties, of course, for which have always been less severe than those in respect of rape and sexual assault. Another consequence is also that the provisions of the minimum sentencing regime, the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1997, will also then be made applicable to a larger number of convictions insofar as the sentencing of offenders is concerned. One of the most obvious concerns there would be what about children if they are convicted. And we just simply point out that the minimum sentences regime is not applicable to persons under the age of 18 years. But to say with regard to the document itself, I'm not going to go through it line by line, except maybe just to highlight to you what the main amendment would be and then what the consequential amendments would be. First of all, on page 3 of the document, at the bottom of page 2 and page 3, you would see that that is the core of the amendments that are proposed, and that is to amend section 57.1 in order to state explicitly that children under the age of 12 years will be incapable of consenting to a sexual act. However, children between the ages of 12 and 16 years will also be incapable of consenting to a sexual act, except or only in those cases where the age gap between the child and the perpetrator is more than 3 years. That is, of course, the teddy bear case proviso, if I might call it that. It can also be 2 years, Mr. Chair. It's just we've used 3 years, but I mean that is something for the legislature to decide in order to determine how far vulnerability among children should be protected. I just wanted to say one after all.
We are entitled to your wisdom, so you can raise your voice.
I apologize. Just to quickly indicate to you the other consequential amendments that will have to be affected to the acting is, of course, the section 1, which deal with the definition of consent. There will be a consequential amendment, which I think that proposed amendment is self-explanatory. The provisions of sections 15 and 16 will be repealed, and then also at this stage the proposal is possibly to amend section 56, which deals with offences, in order to make the deception offence, which is currently applicable to the section 15-16 scenarios, applicable to charges in respect of section 3 and 5. There will also be a transitional provision, Mr. Chair, in terms of which it should just be clarified by the legislature that any offences that have been committed prior to the amendment of the Act will then have to be prosecuted in terms of the old provisions, if I might refer to them as that, the sections 15 and 16 provisions. And then one final consequential amendment will have to be affected to section 261 of the Criminal Procedure Act in order to determine that that provision actually becomes redundant if sections 15 and 16 are appealed, so it's merely a consequential amendment to clean up that section, if I call it so. That, in short, Mr. Day, is the submission on the proposal.
When we train lawyers, it is not compulsory that lawyers should study social sciences. But lawyers have to make laws which affect children. And that forces lawyers to make laws relating to the capacity of children to consent or not consent. And that is a matter that relates to the cognitive development of children. Also, that cognitive development relates to psychological issues. It relates to whether children can have the requisite intent to do this or that. Now the question is, are we as lawyers competent to finalize these matters without the involvement of social scientists? For instance, if we fix a year to 12 or 10, is that not something that the lawyers do arbitrarily? Or if they rely on common law, at the time when the common law was developed, you know, social sciences were not developed to the level that they are now. So is it really justifiable in the 21st century to rely on the common law developed in the 12th century? Shouldn't we be taking advantage of the fact that the social sciences are developed, that we talk to the psychologists, the sociologists on these questions before we really start to change, chop and change the ages? Now, I'm really making a long story to say, maybe before we take a final position on this age, you know, nature actually guides us. You have 7 days of the week. You have children between 7 and 14. You have children between 14 and 21. And after 21, you say they can marry their adults. So already there's guidance from nature. Why are we ignoring nature? And why are we ignoring the wisdom of scientists? Does anyone want to tell me why? Maybe I'm backward and conservative. Honorable Sir.
You make a valid point, and it's an issue we've been raising continually about the cognitive development of children. But it was dealt with quite extensively in the Teddy Bear case with the expert evidence that was led there by psychologists. It was one view which was accepted by the courts, and there was a lot of research developed on that. But really, there's nothing to prevent us also looking into that aspect. Every child differs. Children differ, and the law does recognize that in sentencing, minimum sentencing. But it is difficult when you are setting ages, because even when the Law Commission came up with the draft legislation way back before 2006, they said ages are arbitrary almost. It's arbitrary. They use that term then So it is something I was hoping that we could get more evidence from psychologists. Ms. Beavers came and helped us a lot, and they've done a lot of research. That was one view, again, accepted by the court, but there's nothing that prevents us as well looking into the cognitive development of children. And again, the different ages, we got that very interesting document from UCP, with the different ages. For various things, as I've pointed out, it doesn't seem to be consistency. Every age, there's 12, there's 14, there's 16, there's 21, there's 18, for different issues. And it might need us as Parliament to take a holistic approach at some stage. Because we've got the Children's Act determines ages of 12 for operations. You've got the Termination of Pregnancy Act. You've got different acts in different silos. In terms of this issue, we don't have to take an immediate decision. I agree with you, we can obtain more input. We're still waiting for social development. Maybe they could help us as well. So, Chair, I agree with you when we start looking at cognitive development of children. The one issue, and again, I must emphasize, the court has accepted the findings of the expert evidence that attended to it. The state in case did not tender other expert evidence. But we seem to accept as a normative that children are engaging in adolescent experimentation. I don't know if that is a correct assumption. There are traditional authorities that say this isn't acceptable. The question is, how do we deal with that? So I'm not accepting normative adolescent experimentation is normative that we as Parliament need to encourage. It exists, it happens, that's the reality, and we all are at idem that the criminal law has not addressed that issue. But we need to be very careful terms, and I appreciate why you said it, because you are acting in terms of the Teddy Bear case. That's what the Teddy Bear case found. But there's been a lot of evidence that has been presented to say, well, there are other views that hold a more traditional perspective. My constituency holds a more traditional perspective. But that doesn't mean in reality that adolescents are not engaging in sex. That's an issue we all accept. I've said it in Parliament. And how do we deal with that? And I think in terms of we can't allow that the criminal law has not been found to act as a deterrent. That's the essence of the court case. So, Chair, I don't know if you want to engage this issue further on the cognitive development.
Mr. Bassett and Francisco, this is no reflection on you. This is a separate debate altogether. We're actually questioning ourselves, we as lawmakers, whether our approach is correct. Because you remember what Contralesa said yesterday, they were complaining about our Eurocentric approach. Now we are here sitting and saying the common law. But when we say common law, we're referring to English common law. And in this country, it is not only English common law that applies. We have Roman Dutch law, what is it saying? We have indigenous African law, what is it saying? And if you take African communities, they have their own stages of child development. And they use that knowledge to determine when the children will go for initiations, when the children will be entitled to marry, and all these type of things. And we can't ignore that because the majority of the people in this country are Africans. And if we disregard their views on these matters, we are going to make laws that will not be legitimate in the eyes of the people. We'll have a legal system that is viewed as illegitimate by the people, and it will be difficult to enforce. So I think, therefore, that we should take into account the understandings and positions of all the people of South Africa, so that when we come to a determination, we are sure that it doesn't require more police to enforce. The people themselves will accept the product as their product. Honorable Chavala.
Thank you, Honorable G. I think it's a very complex issue, maybe with no easy answers and no easy way out, but maybe engagement and better engagement will finally help us to separate the fact from the chaff. But I think it's unfortunate for African culture. I speak as a social scientist now. It's unfortunate because, as you have pointed out, and I think Honorable Trust has also touched on it, we live in a global world, and these age groups in terms of what happens at which age, or the normative adolescent experimentation age, is normally set globally. And African culture, most of the time, would dictate the contrary. But because we live in a global world, you find that everything is standardized, so that globally, in terms of the United Nations, it makes sense. So I think you, I support you, you wouldn't have said it in a better way. Whenever we deal with law, I always ask myself the question, why is it even called customary law? That's African law, not Charles. Why is it called customary law? And I'm not always sure why it should be subservient to Roman Dutch law in all of these issues that we deal with. And I mean, the majority of the population of South Africa are African. Our poorest borders are not helping us. Eh? That population of Africans is growing every day. It's not diminishing. So I'm scared that sometimes we make laws that when an ordinary person in Africa, they ask themselves, what are these parliamentarians thinking? Were they sitting somewhere in London and they made this law? Were they sitting in Cape Town? So that is complex, as I say, Honorable Chair. I think engagement, the better engagement, will help us finally to arrive at a common understanding.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable Horn.
Thank you, Chairperson. To a certain extent, I think we are this morning busy ourselves again muddying the water. I don't know whether it's this new Section 57 proposal of the department that has taken us back to more or less where we started. My plea is just that maybe we should, on the one hand, just keep our eyes on the ball. The fact is that even Contralesa yesterday said that, but in terms of their point of view, consensual sex below the age of 16 should not be a criminal act. So we should, I think, rather focus on what all different commentators have more or less had in common when they visited us, and the few that were of the opinion that these acts should be criminalised, I think was really in the vast minority. And for now, I think we should start focusing on clarifying our stance and our response to the point of view or the order of the Constitutional Court. So in trying to do that, my comment would be that whilst I welcome this new proposal from the department, I think it makes our work a bit more difficult in the sense that up to now we have focused heavily on clearing up and streamlining sections 15 and 16 and maybe also coming up strongly as to reconfirm the age of consent. And I'm just scared that if we go this route of section 57 that there will be a lot of possibly unintended consequences. So my point of view is just that if we contemplate going this route, then we will not really have to reopen this whole process, but we will have to have more sessions looking into what consequences also in terms of other legislation will be on this whole process. Thank you.
Yesterday, Honorable Bonga and myself participated in a community radio station debate. And if you listen to the questions which committees raise, you will find that they don't keep their eyes on the ball. They go even beyond the ball. So if we keep our eyes exclusively on the ball, we may be missing the ball, because we are accountable to the people. So we must look at issues from all angles so that we are able to answer. And in fact, I want to request the media people, parliamentary media, to get more slots so that all political parties represented in this country have an opportunity to participate and hear what the people are saying, so that all of us, you know, answer to the aspirations of the people. Honorable Majake and Honorable Bunga.
Thank you, Mr. President. We welcome the submission on possible amendments to Section 57 of the Act. Indeed, when one looks at it, that what is suggested is incapacity of children to consent to sex between 12 and 16, something that appears to actually bring about a valid argument. Though the concern would have been what happens if there is a complaint between children within that age group. But I think that is actually catered for in Section 56, when you look at defense, that actually takes into consideration the age gap, that is B, 56B, that actually indicates that if the age is not more than 2 years, then Section 57 will apply. But if it's less than 2 years, then it means the matter will be handled otherwise. I think these are some of the things that continue to say to us, we need to get the social scientists to come in and look at cognitive ability and development of children, especially also when you look at the argument around criminal capacity of children. We are saying that we are raising it up to 12 now. But at the same time, why we are creating 15 and 16 is because of the fact that we wanted to decriminalize children when it comes to sexual activity and consent around sexual activity. Do we still want to regard children as criminals in that regard? That's the question that I'm actually asking.
Globalization, Honorable Shabalala. Africa was under colonial rule until the 60s. So when these positions were developed at the international level, Africa was not there. And we fought for the right of self-determination. And that includes the right to make our own country. So we can't just say, because things are global, we accept things that actually continue to victimize us and our children. So we should keep the debate open about some of these issues. Honorable Bonga.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think we have two issues. One, they've raised the matter that in terms of the 1757, we have to, I think it has something to do with the retrospective effect of the application. So, now that there is a decision of the Constitutional Court, what is happening, what is currently happening now? Because he will have to still continue to prosecute those that have done things before we pass this legislation. What is the real effect of the Constitutional Court decision as at now? Because it may be important that we get that very clear. And then secondly, I see the Section 57 it appears to be progressive. It's a progressive move. And it looks like it is dealing with a lot of other issues that we have dealt with. But just like Honorable Juan is saying, if you make a matter of all the presentation that you've taken, it will appear that the majority of the groupings actually agreed with the amendments as they stand. And what I want to know is the main, would the processing of the bill itself starts from the department, it must go to cabinet. Then after cabinet, it comes to us. Now, the one that was taken to cabinet was with regard to section 15 and 16. That's what cabinet they really lose. What would be the indication now that we want to look at this section 57? Do we need to start the process de novo? Or what would be the implication? Because at the same time, I think we need to strike a good balance. At the same time, we must not start this process anew. And at the same time, we must also be able to frustrate this thing. Because I'm sure what the National Prosecution said here yesterday was they've piled all the cases that relate to this matter until we finalize. So we may not have to create a problem for the prosecution authorities. Piling and us having to delay taking this legislation. So I think those are my words, Chair. I would want to get the state lawyers are serving to just take us through that point. Thank you.
Dr. Bonga, it's no longer compulsory to choose. When you say de novo, you'll get us into trouble. De novo, can you just explain what you mean by de novo for the rest of us?
Do you want to do so, Honorable Swart?
To start the process afresh, because when the measure was put before us, we were dealing with Section 15 and 16, not 57. But actually, also as a follow-up to that, why can't the changes be made retrospective, but applied backward? Over to you.
Thank you, Jeff. If I may respond to Honourable Bonga's question and observations relating to Cabinet's involvement and so on, I want to reiterate here that when we prepared this option, and I said it's an option, it's an option that we prepared at the request of the committee, at the request of the legislature. What the department still has on the table and still recommends as a bill is introduced, and we've heard people say it, that lots of the commentators were in support of the bill as introduced. And I think what a sense of ease that the bill as introduced does what the Constitutional Court requires of us. And with the fact that Cabinet has approved the bill as introduced, that is very, very true. This, as I said yesterday, is a whole new line of thinking. It hasn't been consulted on. So if it has to be pursued, I'm sure there'd have to be a de novo consultation process. But I also understand, not only Cabinet, but I think there's a rule of Parliament, something to be aligned to the effect that if a bill makes a drastic departure from as introduced, there is some approval requirement. And I'm not clued up on the rules of Parliament, but I think it's similar to the Cabinet situation. Cabinet is no longer involved because the bill is in the legislature. And I would like some confirmation on that rule of Parliament, which suggests that if you have something like this, you might need to get the approval of the National Assembly. I'm going to ask my colleagues to deal with the other questions. Thank you.
I think we will get advice on that, but whatever it may be, I think it is a useful exercise to consider this proposal, because it arises from the deliberations that have been going on, so that when we take the final decision, nobody should say that we didn't consider their proposal. So it was not a waste of time, and actually it's, as you indicate, is within the rules, either through the legislature or through cabinet. So we still thank you for that initiative. It was that one. Are you still looking for that?
Yes. But my understanding is that it goes back to the National Assembly. Because we're dealing with an amendment bill here, it's now in the hands of the legislature. It doesn't have to go back to cabinet. We are Parliament. We make the law. But because we as a committee on our changing the bill as tabled, it would require a tabling before the House for the House to resolve that they forbid to accept that. And I agree with you that the proposal comes as a result of consultation, so I do not think we need to start de novo with public hearings again. This flows directly from public hearings and sentiments that have been expressed. But so we have done this in the past, where we have amended an amendment bill, and then it goes back to Parliament. But I'm subject to the rules. I'm just speaking off the top of my head. I might be wrong, Chair. Thanks.
So I think that the department has done the work very well. We can't keep them here whilst looking for rules, because Parliament has its own lawyers. The lawyers of Parliament do their work here, like the department lawyers have done their work. And I don't really think that we should still be sitting here waiting for Parliament to do its work. Honourable Hall?
Yes, sir. I don't want to get into the debate of whether it must be de novo or not, but the fact is that if we go the second 57 route, I believe there will be a lot of those who came here and presented who would like another opportunity to express themselves on the alternative we are now contemplating in dealing with the issue.
That's why we said that we expect the Legal Aid South Africa to make a submission on this proposal, and that we should communicate with all others who have appeared before us, inform them of the recent development, and invite them to make submissions. So we are perfectly right. So I don't think that we still need to pursue this matter further. We can conclude it by saying invitations go to the Legal Aid South Africa and all others who present to comment on this. By the time we consider those submissions, Parliament will have advised us as to what is the correct procedure on their side. But Honorable Swart, you are right, the matter is before us, and we have all the authority to deal with it in terms of the rules of Parliament. Proceed.
To get my thinking around, and we still engage just to understand what is proposed by the new proposal. I think that just is for a few minutes. But was there something else you wanted to respond to before that?
Chief, thank you. Maybe just to raise a few issues or to try and respond to some of the issues that were raised. Insofar as putting the ages of consent is concerned, the Constitutional Court accepted that that can be changed. But the Constitutional Court importantly accepted that ages, the age gap of 12 to 16 is what they call bright line rules. And the applicants in the case didn't attack that. They accepted 12 to 16. I'm just mentioning that. Indicated to the committee, and as it was indicated in the committee itself, paragraph 3 of the judgment indicates that the judgment is not about the age of consent or whether children should engage in sexual conduct or not. It was limited to that one aspect, and that is the criminalization of children engaged consensually with each other between the ages of 12 and 16. So far as the common law is concerned, Mr. Chair, we didn't go immediately to the common law. We accepted the act, but we questioned one thing, and that is the act indicates to us that a child under the age of 12 is incapable of consenting. So if a 30-year-old has sexual intercourse with a willing, if I may say so, in inverted commas, child of 11 years old, the willingness of that child is irrelevant for purposes of being convicted of the offence of rape. So I would like to refer then to an automatic conviction of rape. The question of consent is irrelevant. But if you look at sections 15 and 16, then you can't but ask yourself whether sections 15 and 16 do not create a fiction. Because section 15 and 16, as a result of the fact that you have the lower age of 12, which indicates you that you are incapable of consenting, sections 15 and 16 come and say, you are able to consent, but your consent for purposes of this offence is irrelevant. It just simply doesn't make sense. And that's why we tried to get an answer. Why was that offence created? And we had to go to the common law, and I think we found the answer. And the answer was that we had a common law rule which determined 12. There was a need to protect the sexual integrity of children who are older than 12. But the legislature, in all likelihood at that stage, decided to do nothing about the common law rule, but to create this offence of committing immoral acts with children, which, by the way, was never called statutory rape or statutory sexual assault or whatever. There were problems with Section 14. Those problems were addressed, among others, the fact that the Law Reform Commission recommended 16 as the age for purposes of legal certainty, because that provision, the old Section 14, had actually done two things. It said that a child above the age of 16 can consent to what we now have as sexual penetration. But the Act also said that a child who is only above the age of 19 would be able to consent to adult sexual violation. In our present terms now, it was called acts of immorality or something like that, Mr. Chief. But what I'm trying to say is, for the less serious types of acts, there was a higher requirement for consent than for the penetrative act, which requires lower. And that was fixed. And in that process, the Law Reform Commission recommended 16. They accepted and they indicated in the report that it's arbitrary. But I think the leeway is there for the legislature to decide about ages of consent. In fact, it might be a wise thing to do if you look at the other provisions of the Act. For example, the grooming provisions and the pornography provisions. But just to explain, Chair, that we had to go back and try and search for answers on why exactly did the legislature at some stage say, you can consent but your consent is irrelevant. It's just saying you're incapable of consenting. And that is where the thought process went further then.
Why we need social scientists these days with things called sugar daddies. And many families are poor. Children need money. And these sugar daddies come and give children money, and children consent because they need money. So children are vulnerable. They may consent where they would not ordinary consent, but because they are poor, then they consent. So I think we really have to identify social scientists as well, invite them to come here, because we are making laws for society, not for lawyers. So we need really to understand societies and the challenges that are facing societies before we finalize some of these things about ages. But I think you have done the best for us, and then we just need to get additional information. Honorable Swart,
just ask, we've also got the submission from Child, the Center for Child Law, that we asked them. And I'd like you to just comment on that, and then I'd like the MPA to comment on this proposal. But help me just, because the benefit of the child line was that it makes it very clear that during the public submissions, we as a committee want to send the message out that we are not condoning children engaging in sex. And that's why the child line is helpful, because it states, particularly sub C, the age of consent to acts of sexual penetration is 16 years. And that sends a very clear message, because that is what the debates that I've been engaged in on the media, people are concerned. And there isn't an appreciation about what decriminalization means. They are concerned that we are, in effect, allowing children to engage in these acts. So that is why I like what they are suggesting, because it makes it very clear. And the Constitutional Court said, as Parliament can deal with the age of consent. So I'd like you to look at that, because it sends the message out what the existing position is. It just makes it very clear. That's the first point. The second point is, I'd like you to unpack why you say 3 years, because when I read the submission, it's basically what you're saying here is that the leap that you're taking is that there's no longer going to be statutory rape. And that's a massive leap. And I'm not saying I don't support you, because we have to send a very strong message out in view of the high degree of sexual offences against children. So in fact, a child under the age of 16 will not be able to consent. But if you have 3 year, you're now extending the upper limit, where it was, in terms of your bill at the moment, the upper level is 18, now it's going up to 19 is the possibility, if I understand correctly. Because if you've got 3 years, a 16-year-old and a 19-year-old can now agree. So that is again, you're lifting the issue there. So I would have a problem with 3 years. But the practical implication is that any adult that has sex with a 16-year-old or lower, where there isn't that age gap, will be charged with rape, even if the child consents. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And that is what we need to understand as a committee. That is the proposal on the table. It will be rape because no child, they are incapable of consenting. The children themselves will be able to consent as long as there is that 3 year, as this proposal is, or 2 years, or whatever we would agree to. Yes, Chair.
Would it not be fair to say we ask them to develop a proposal which they have done to the best of their ability, and we agree that we need now submissions on that proposal, and that the right timing for your good questions would be when we consider submissions on that proposal?
As our purpose, we need to understand what the proposal is, and I just need to get the assurance that my understanding is correct. But I would also suggest here that if we send this out, that we also send out the child line proposal, unless you've got serious objections from the department side, because that is the second proposal that we requested. So we need as a committee to decide whether we send that proposal out as well, not zero.
Child line proposal would be one of other submissions when we deal with the matter, because to send it out would suggest that we have a position on that, and I don't think we have as a committee. The only position I think we have is the mandated proposal from the department, and I think that's the one that was sent out. Mr. Francian?
Thank you, Chief. To preach, Chief. And I would like to put on record that eventually I was to proceed, I can guarantee. I'm the <prayer. laughs> Thank you for creating the humor, sir. I would like to answer the second question first, because what I would like to propose, Mr. Chair, before we indicate what our concerns are with regard to the Center for Child Law's proposal, I don't know whether you would like them to address you on their proposal, but if you determine that we should immediately indicate to you what our concerns are, I will do so. But let me answer the second question first, Chair, and then I will give you an opportunity to make a ruling on that proposal. Why the 3 years? There's no reason for that. When we drafted the provision, we said 2 years, and then the second version of it included 3 years. Those are the issues that will have to be determined by Parliament, how far that range of vulnerability should be regarded as. The department at this stage does not have a specific recommendation to make in this regard. When you look at the 10-bed judgment, a very interesting thing happened. When the judgment came out, most thought that the court said that 12 to 16-year-olds, so that is a period of 4 years. But if you interpret the judgment strictly, the order of the court clearly indicates that sections 15 and 16 are unconstitutional to the extent that children under the age of 16 are criminalized. So I think, Mr. Dare, just as it was indicated in the committee, that the age of consent is something that is still debatable, possibly even that age gap is still something that may be debatable. Otherwise, one would have been bound by the Teddy Bear case, and one would have had to use a 4 year instead of a 3 or a 2 year. Merely a proposal, we're noting that, so that the committee appreciates that those are one of the pertinent issues that will have to be discussed by the committee. And yes, that is indeed so. If a 30-year-old commits an act of sexual penetration with a 15-year-old, the scenario will be exactly the same as a 30-year-old committing an act of sexual penetration with an 11-year-old. The consent is simply irrelevant, and it will be a charge of rape or sexual assault. And if the victim is under 16, then minimum sentences even becomes involved and applicable. And if there's no substantive and compelling circumstances to justify a lesser sentence, then the prescribed sentence will be imposed on the person who is convicted. Mr. Chair, I think at this stage, possibly can I just request you for a ruling? Should I respond immediately to the proposal, or would you like to afford them the opportunity just to take you through the proposal?
Honourable Short, are you happy with what has been explained now? Can I proceed to the second stage? You may proceed.
Thank you.
Do you have an engagement on a child line submission? We might want to hold that over until they have presented their argument.
Let's hold it over.
Okay.
So could we say that, conclude that? Or you still want to?
In Paris, have you got any views on this yet, or would you like to keep it in until any further consent?
Thank you, Chair. I think it would probably be appropriate for us to wait in further consideration of the proposal. We've also just really had an opportunity to look at it from yesterday, and I think it would be advisable for us to take it back to our principals and have a clear consideration about it. So I think it's probably more appropriate to wait.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. There's just one other issue that I wanted to clarify for the committee. Like the question of retrospectivity was raised. And we should just keep in mind that the court's order merely relates to that prosecutions of that age group and not the prosecution of adult persons who commit those offences against children. So it's a very small number of cases that are affected in terms of this judgment and the moratorium placed by the court. The court had to place that moratorium because it suspended its declaration of invalidity to afford Parliament the opportunity to address the constitutional concerns.
I guess we all agree that we are not reopening public hearings on matters which were concluded. We have a further option, so we want to consult on the further option and invite submissions on that option. So when the invitations go out, it must be very clear what we are asking for. And then we will have another opportunity then to engage on submission on this specific submission. But also this question of involving the psychologists, social scientists, it may not be relevant for our immediate purposes. But I think it's important for us as lawmakers to know that we make laws for society. So we need to understand the society for which we legislate. And law relates to intentions of people, capacity of people, and these are the matters that do not fall within the competence of lawyers. So lawyers must not arrogate to themselves the right to know even what they were not trained trained for. And also ourselves as lawmakers, we really have to listen more to legal experts, to social experts, to communities and everybody, so that our laws reflect the will of the people, not the will of ourselves as individuals who happen to be in this August House. But thank you very much. I think it was a very interesting engagement. I see a hand at the back.
Thank you, Chair. I did not mean to disturb you. I just wanted to seek on that issue of de novo that the committee was discussing. I would have been reluctant to speak on it because I had not consulted the rules. I've had an opportunity now to consult the rule, and in terms of section of Rule 2493B of the National Assembly Rules, there would be a need for the committee to seek the permission of the Assembly in order for it to make an amendment of the Principal Act, which was not in the amendment, in the introduced amendment. It therefore confirms the court's view that it wouldn't have to go back to the department to discuss it in order. If Chairperson prefers, I could prepare some written advice to present in the committee tomorrow.
Please do that, and Honorable Sart, you are vindicated. So we'll get a written confirmation for that. Thank you very much. I think this should bring to an end our meeting today. And thank you very much for... Mr. Bunch, I I was under the impression that you had taken us through your responses and told that was not done.
The document was only circulated, I think, the day before yesterday. So we haven't taken the committee through the responses.
Oh, no, because I read it before yesterday. I thought that everybody read it. Okay, fine. Over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I accept all the committee members have got that document. It's quite a thick document of 76 pages. It's a document that summarizes the submissions that were made during the course of the public hearing held by this committee. Summary was done very kindly by the officials of the committee, and the department has supplied the responses. I'm not too sure how you want us to deal with it. May I just start at the beginning and just go through each of the issues that were raised and the department's responses there too. I think I've done when we did the legislative bills last year. I beg your pardon, Chair?
Do the latter.
As we did last time. Thank you. I'm going to ask again my colleague, Mr. Dupreer, to assist us with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 4 of the summary, the recommendation is that the age of sexual consent be increased to 18 years. Our response to that was to indicate that the South African Law Reform Commission considered in its report that age limits are set arbitrarily, but recommended 16 years as the age limit, among others, to promote legal certainty. The age of consent for acts of sexual penetration has been 16 years for at least the past 58 years. In that regard, we can refer you again to Section 14 of the Sexual Offences Act. The section was replaced by the current sections 15 and 16. We would like to indicate that the department is not necessarily opposed to lifting the age limit to 18 years, but is concerned about the implications insofar as experimentation among adolescents is concerned. The age group will be extended from a 12 to 16 year group to a category of 12 to 18 years, which increases the risk of vulnerable children being exploited by older, more mature children.
This is going to take some hours to go through this issue, so it is maybe wiser to get through it as quickly as possible. We could end up engaging on every point.
But also, is it a correct understanding to say that we don't want to comment on things that were dealt with before? Just the new issues that have arisen, so that the volume should not matter. There are certain things that are agreed that are obvious and we should not be dealing with them.
No, we understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will try my best to then only highlight to the committee our responses to pertinent issues. And I'm going to take you through the document page by page. For example, on page 5, I don't see anything to highlight for you. I think the responses there are self-explanatory and clear. Page 6 as well. Yes, page 7, the department has just noted the expression of support for the proposed amendments. Maybe on the bottom of page 8 we can just indicate to you that we have noted the response with regard to the adverse consequences of decriminalisation. However, the bill aims to give effect to the Constitutional Court's judgment in terms of which it was established that the criminal law should not be used to criminalise normal sexual experimentation. I think that's also a common cause in committee already. same on page 8 here. I don't think there's anything to highlight for you there, as well as page 10, 11. Mr. Chair, I think in the far as the recommendations with regard to sections 15 and 16 are concerned, they are repetitive, they are of the same nature. I think we should possibly take you to the recommendations insofar as the register is concerned. Those things have not necessarily been highlighted so much in the committee so far. While I'm speaking, Mr. Chair, I'm just checking whether there isn't something that comes out of the pages which might have to be noted by the committee insofar as the department's responses are concerned. I am not finding anything at this stage, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, yes, maybe I could just highlight for the information of the committee, right at the bottom of page 21, we have the response to the proposal by the South African Bishop, the South African Catholic Bishops Conference with regard to lowering, or the proposal that the minimum age of 12 should be lowered to 10. We have pointed the aspects that are mentioned on those pages to you during our briefing on the proposed amendment, so it will merely be repetition, but we would still like to just indicate to the committee that there is quite an extensive response in that regard. Now I said 28, at the bottom of 28. At the bottom of 28. Thank you, Mr. Deport. Up to page 31. That takes us through pages 31, 32, 33, 33. We could possibly again just highlight the response to the South African Catholic Bishops Conference at the bottom of page 33 up to 35, but I think once again that is something at this stage we actually addressed that concern during our briefing of the committee. 35, 36, yes, this is something new, Mr. Chair. On page 37, I would like to take you back to page 35, Mr. Chair, and that's the whole issue of the delegation of the decision to institute prosecutions. Our response was that to the Legal Resources Center and also the Women's Legal Center and a few others, is that the department is concerned that centralization of decision making may impact negatively on the finalization of cases.
Madam Chair, just on that aspect, there were quite a few submissions to say that the decision to prosecute in the interests of uniformity should be dealt with by the NDPP, and then some were okay with it being delegated to the DPP, Director of Public Prosecutions, but there was quite a strong sense of opposition to this delegation that is in our book, and you can see what our response is, that it might affect the finalization of cases negatively. With your consent, may I ask Ms. Pitty from NPA perhaps to address the committee from a practical point of view and from experience on matters of this nature? And if I remember correctly, she might have an alternative proposal. And with your permission, may Advocate Pitty address us on that?
Thank you, Advocate Brassett. Still maybe coming to the presentation that you made earlier. I think maybe we might need some form of relative summary, because it needs something that's also supposed to clearly justify amendment of the, Section 67. Just a one-pager, because there are certain areas that you're actually pulling out that leads to the justification. If you could do so, it will actually help to facilitate the approaches. Over to you, Advocate Peter.
Thank you, Chair. You would have remembered our submission yesterday, which we've also made available, obviously, to the committee in written form. On the third page of our, my apologies, on the fourth page of our submission, we said that we're in support of the current formulation in the bill. And what we propose is that there may be a need for an amendment to the regulations, which would mean, sorry, not to the regulations, I apologize, to section 662A21, which refers to the NPA directives, which may give an indication or should give an indication in terms of what criteria should be used if it should be referred to the DDP for decision. So at the moment we would support the delegation, mainly because there are practical implications in terms of sending these cases to the DPP for decision. It will delay cases quite substantially. And secondly, the senior prosecutors and control prosecutors in courts are making decisions around very serious cases from the institutional prosecution, such as murder, rape, armed robbery. And I understand the thinking behind it, that we don't want arbitrary prosecutions, but at the moment the cases that are referred to DPP for decision are considered the more serious cases. And it feels a bit counterintuitive to now send cases where one doesn't want an arbitrary institution of a prosecution. It almost means that it feels like we're opening the door that basically all cases should then be sent to the DPP for decision. I just think it's going to have a profound effect on the finalisation of those cases, even though there may be very few of these cases. It's all very well to say there are very few of these cases, but these cases will be dealt with in the context of the DPP's dealing with all cases that are referred to in the decision, and cases that are sitting with the DPP's anyway.
Any comments from members? In the absence of any, can we proceed? Though one thing that comes to my mind is, what would you regard this as? Is something that we need to also interrogate. You actually make reference to serious cases, as to how you would actually define what is serious.
My referral or reference to serious is in the broad context of all offences that are committed, not only sexual offences. At the moment, there are DDP per province instructions to the lower courts in terms of which cases must be referred to the DPP office for decision. So, for example, in the Western Cape, there is a list of offences, and it involves child murders, involves trafficking cases. It doesn't necessarily mean that those cases will be prosecuted in the High Court. It means that those cases must be decided by the DPP in terms of an institutional prosecution. So when I talk about serious, I'm not necessarily talking about sexual offence cases. The vast majority of our sexual offence cases are dealt by the regional courts, other than cases that often involve child murders if there was a sexual offence, as well, like I said, trafficking, fraud cases which involve amounts that exceed particular levels that we've decided upon. I don't know if that indicates what I'm referring to.
Okay, my impression was that we're actually looking at cases that have got to do with putting the children's names in the register, where the division will actually be based.
My understanding of what we're talking about here is a decision to prosecute with children who fall outside the prescribed, at the moment, in terms of the bill, outside of the 3-year protection time period. My understanding is that. In terms of the, I think maybe what you may be referring to is the issue of placing the children onto the National Register. And what we have proposed in, which I'm now diverging a little bit, but what we proposed there is that it was referred to that the onus shifts to the NPA to make an application to place certain children onto the register, which has nothing to do with DPP decision. That would be dealt with in the forum where the trial had taken place.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 37, there are two recommendations that I would like to bring to the committee's attention. The one recommendation is by Justice Lyon South Africa, recommending that the term kissing should be deleted from the definition of sexual violation. The department indicates that it does not support the proposal. The definitions in the Act and should always be kept in mind apply to all offences that have been created in terms of the Act. The definition of sexual violation is very wide to cover all acts which may amount to sexual assault. Therefore, we do not support that proposal. The Children's Institute proposes that the term or the definition of sexual violation should be replaced by sexual stimulation. We once again indicate that the definition of sexual violation has been in place and used since 2007. We argue that it will not be in the interest of legal certainty to change a well-established definition with something like stimulation, which term in itself is not entirely appropriate for purposes of the Act. I am on page 38. I'm going over to page 39. Madam Chair, there is also, once again, at the bottom of page 39, a proposal by the Children's Institute that amounts to a change in definitions. I think we've already indicated that we do not support any amendments to the definitions at this stage. You could merely note our response there. Page 41, Madam Chair, nothing spectacular to report there. Page 42. The Commission on Gender Equality at the bottom of page 42 indicated that it does not support the proposed amendment of section 16.1b. They indicate, or the concern is, that the decriminalisation of children is limited to children between the ages of 12 and 16 years. They recommend or state that that decriminalisation should be extended to 16 and 17 year olds as well. The department's response is that the recommendation that decriminalisation should extend to 16 and 17 year olds is covered in terms of the proposed amendment of the Act. And those are one of the very first questions that were raised during our briefing, why 16 and 17 year olds were included. So that is also an issue which the committee has already noted, Mr. Chair. We get to page 43, Mr. Chair, and I think this is where we might have to go a bit slower. And I'm going to ask my colleague, Mr. Bassett, to assist me here as well, especially with regard to the proposals dealing with the amendment of the provisions which deal with the assistance. If you look on page 43, the South African Human Rights Commission has made a number of practical proposals, Madam Chair, and we argue that those proposals cannot necessarily or cannot be addressed in terms of the legislation, but there are other structures that have been created, especially in terms of this Act. For example, the Investigatory Committee on Sexual Offences, which could be used to notify that structure of the proposals by the South African Human Rights Commission and for them to discuss and consider the feasibility of those proposals and then, if found to be sound, implemented as well. So insofar as the practical recommendations are concerned, that will be the standard response to that. page 44, the bottom of that page, it is something that was inserted by the department. I'm going to request Mr. Bassett to take you through that one, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Barry made comments on this, but the Constitutional Court, in its judgment right at the end, in its order, directed the Minister, and I quote, to take all steps necessary to ensure that when a court has convicted a child under the age of 16 years of an offence referred to the 13, sections 15 or 16 of the Act, or issued a diversion order following a charge under the provisions, the details of the child will not appear in the National Register for Sex Offenders, and a certificate of expungement must be issued directing that the conviction and sentence or diversion of such order of such child be expunged. So that the court ordered that in the event of there being children on the register who have committed or be convicted of 6, 15 or 16, those records must be expunged. And we questioned, interrogated this order because although we quite agree with it, it's absolutely correct. We just raised the question whether there's a procedure in terms of which to do that, because in terms of the Criminal Procedure Act, where expungements are dealt with, certain criteria have to be met and certain processes have to be gone through to give effect to what needs to be done. And those processes aren't in any legislation to deal with, to give effect to what the Constitutional Court wants us to do. So we are proposing an amendment to insert a section, new 69A, in the Act in order to cater for the expungement of criminal records of children who have been convicted of contravening sections 15 or 16, or also similar offences in terms of any repealed legislation, because the Sexual Offences Act has only been in operation for since 2007. There might have been children who were convicted of section 14, Mr. Dupree has spoken about. So you need to cater for the event of children getting onto the register for similar offences. Now we say let's create this, but I do not know, and I think that we can accept that there are very few children who have in fact been convicted of this offence. I just want to see here that we propose that the bill be amended to cater for any case that may surface in the future, although we do not think that there are any people or very few people that this will have to apply for, but I think we need to give effect to what the Constitutional Court wants. So that is something for the committee to consider. It hasn't been raised before. It hasn't been suggested by any of the NGOs. This is a proposal by the department for the committee's consideration.
Can I open for comments and questions from members at this point, including the insertion of new section 69A?
It's fine, Chair. When we deliver it, but it's progressive.
Thank you very much, Honourable Bongo. Can you proceed, Advocate, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the bottom of page 49, the Women and Men Against Child Abuse recommends that there is a separate section in the National Register for Child Sex Offenders. The department's response is, since there are very strict confidentiality provisions in the chapter dealing with the National Register of Sex Offenders, it's not clear what the rationale would be for creating a separate section in the NSRO for child sexual offenders. The need for guidelines is also questioned since the proposed new provisions aim to ensure that the court will be provided with all relevant information on a case-by-case basis, which will promote the individualized justices mentioned in the Constitutional Court. A similar response was given to the recommendation by CRIP that a register for child sexual offenders should be created. Page 50, nothing to really highlight further, Madam Chair. There is a proposal by the Legal Resources Centre reflected on page 51 at the top, where the recommendation is that section 52A should be amended, and then it is quoted, the proposed amendment is quoted. However, in this regard, we have pointed out a number of technical concerns. For example, replacing the word must with may in section 52A of the Act means that the court will be afforded discretion to decide whether the particulars of all offenders and not only child offenders should be included in the register or not. And the proposed new paragraph C creates the exception to the rule, and the rule is then, of course, reflected in paragraph A. We argue that if the proposed wording is accepted, it should rather than be accommodated in the new paragraph C. But I think that is also something that will be considered and finally decided upon during the further deliberations of the committee. Page 52. Yes, I think we will really have to take our time now, Madam Chair, because here we are at the stage where we have the recommendations in the summary which deal with technical aspects, especially with regard to the proposed amendment of Section 52. I'm going to ask Mr. Bassett just to assist us and take us through this strategy.
So that is page 53, Child Law Center has made a proposal. I already touched on it this morning when Legal Aid South Africa made its submission. And that's in respect of clause, let me check my bill, clause 7 I think it is. Clause 7, just to refresh your memory, says this is relating to the inclusion of a child's name on the register. Our proposal in the bill is as follows. Before making an order in terms of paragraph A, the court must, 1, inform a person who was a child at the time of the commission of the offence of the court's power to make an order in terms of paragraph A, and 2, afford the person of 15 subparagraph 1 an opportunity to address the court as to why such an order should not be made, whereafter the court may direct that particulars of such a person shall not be included in the register. Now, our law centre is saying that it supports our amendment that is contained in the bill, because it is in line with the Day case, but there might be some areas, problematic areas. First thing, Child Law Centre says its provisions are based on the idea that all offenders should be placed on the register, whereas the Constitutional Court was clear that adult and child sex offenders are very different and should be treated differently. Child Law Centre says although the proposals allow the child to make submissions to the court, this places a heavy burden on the child. Thirdly, Child Law Centre says that the bill is not clear on whether an assessment should be carried out before a decision is made to place that child's name on the register, and that this aspect pays insufficient attention to the Constitutional Court's views on assessment. Child Law Centre goes on to say if assessments are to be done, who will pay, the state or the child? Law Centre raises that question. Goes on to say that the current formulation will cause the majority of child sex offenders to be assessed, which is expensive and inefficient. And it says that the particulars of a child sex offender should not be included in the register unless there are substantial and compelling circumstances to warrant this. The circumstances should not be prescribed by the court, should not be prescribed, but left for the court to decide. And the prosecutor should apply the court's should apply to the court for the child's details to be placed on the register. This would be in the prosecutor's discretion and would depend on the severity of the offence, the history of the offender, the circumstances surrounding the offence, and such other factors that the prosecutor may take into consideration. If there's an application by the prosecution, then the offender's name would not be included on the register. Child Law Centre argues that this approach should only see those children who pose a risk to society being assessed for inclusion, and this mechanism would ensure that resources
are targeted at children in most need of assessment. And if the child has to bear this expense, in all likelihood, it is legal aid that will need to bear this cost. And I asked that question to legal aid this morning, and we got their response. Legal aid South Africa would come to the assistance of children if there is an assessment that needs to be done. So that is what Child Law Centre is saying, and then they come up with very useful, I may say, recommendations in terms of proposed provisions to give effect to what they are actually saying. I won't go through what the provisions say. I won't read them. I think honourable members can have a look at it, but basically it gives effect to what I just said law child or sentence is arguing for. Our response is that we're not necessarily opposed to the recommendation, and that it will indeed reduce the number of cases in which assessments have to be made. But we do have some concerns, and I don't know whether we actually have the answers yet. And let me just table those concerns. What a child law centre is saying that maybe this could also be dealt with in terms of regulations. We say that regulations might delay implementation of the amendment bill. That's not a huge concern. But what we do worry about is because Child Law Centre is saying that these assessments must be done by suitably qualified persons. And our question is, will professionals be able to make for conclusive findings during the course of these assessments whether a particular child will re-offend against children in the future? And that is one of the difficulties that we have. Who is prepared to make a finding like that? And if I can take Ms. Haas through a similar challenge that the department is experiencing in relation to the determination of criminal capacity of children in terms of the Child Justice Act. The Child Justice Act also says that the state must prove that a child has criminal capacity, and a child must be assessed for that purpose. And it says that the assessments must be done by suitably qualified persons. And those suitably qualified persons are determined by way of regulations. And the suitably qualified persons for purposes of criminal capacity have been determined as psychologists and psychiatrists. But the department is having a look at broadening that to those categories of persons to determine criminal capacity. And a workshop was held, I think, about two, three weeks ago. And there it emerged that even psychologists and psychiatrists have huge difficulty in saying with any certainty that a particular child has criminal capacity or not, despite the expertise that they have and the tests that are at their disposal. So what we are grappling with here is also who is a suitably qualified person to say in an assessment or after an assessment of the child whether the child is going to re-offend and commit a sexual offence against children or mentally disabled persons in the future. So that's the one thing that we're grappling with. We must make that choice. The other that emerged from that workshop that I'm telling honourable members about is that in practice, the prosecution experiences enormous difficulty in getting the qualified people who are willing to come and do the assessments. Those that are prepared to come and do them are few and far between. They have difficulty in doing it, and they are also not very happy with the tariffs that are set by the department to do this very important work. So we're grappling with that, with those issues. Will a professional be able to say with certainty that a child will re-offend, and where you're going to get these people? So that's one concern that we have about Child Law Centre's proposals. There was another NGO that made a submission in this regard, I think it was the Legal Resources Centre, who said, why don't we use the pre-sentencing reports in the Child Justice Act? In terms of the Child Justice Act, every child is convicted of offence before sentence is imposed. A probation officer must do a pre-sentence report, and maybe the NPA can help us here as well. So there is already a mechanism in place to do these assessments. Now, who are probation officers? They are social workers, as far as I'm aware. The question has to be asked, are social workers better placed than psychologists or psychiatrists to make a determination of that nature? I don't have a clear answer on that, but what I do like about the legal resources proposal is that you're using an existing mechanism to do these assessments. But whether a probation officer can do them, I'm not quite sure. The challenge might be addressed by the wording of the proposal. The wording suggested by Child Law Centre is to the effect that do an assessment to determine whether the child will re-offend again. Later one must have a look at the wording so that the focus of the assessment is not necessarily so difficult to do. So those are the issues that are out there, Chair, and we still need to grapple with. But the department does support the model that's been put on the table by Child Law Centre. And maybe I could ask with your permission for Philly just to talk a bit about experience in pre-sentence reports and the role played by probation officers.
Over to you, Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe I could start with the, start at the end where Advocate Battles has referred to. There's not much more that I can add to what he said in terms of the challenges that the NPA faces in terms of the criminal capacity evaluations that need to be done in terms of the Child Justice Act, that's Section 11.3. We are experiencing extensive problems with resources, and because at the moment the regulations prescribe a very narrow band of people who are suitably qualified, those people are very few and far between. And the next issue is that even when we get those criminal capacity reports, both the NPA and the courts are battling for guidance from those psychiatrists and psychologists. So if we were to put a similar provision into this Act, I foresee similar practical challenges. The other concern that I have for this proposal is that as a capacitor referred to, it would seem that the proposal refers to an assessment that would establish only one criteria, whether the child will reoffend again. And I'm concerned that that would not necessarily be the only criteria that should be considered. There are other criteria that may be relevant to whether the child should go onto the register, such as the nature of the offence, the violence that may accompany, whether the child is a second or third offender, things like that. So I think to restrict it only to whether the child will commit further offence needs to be reconsidered. In terms of the wording around the committing of the second offence, I really battle with the word will, because that means that someone has to come to court and say, definitely will, and it means predicting the future, and I battle with that. It's a very strong word. So maybe we could put something in there together with other criteria around possibly the risk of reoffending, something like that. But, you know, I do understand that the need for someone who's suitably qualified to make such a prediction, even based on very strong criteria that a psychologist and psychiatrist need, I just know the practical implications are serious. And in terms of the criminal capacity, we're something that the department is busy formulating recommendations for this committee. There are definitely going to be other proposals on the table rather than doing these evaluations. So, not rather than doing these evaluations, but using own psychologists and psychiatrists. So I think we will need to look at the possibility that probation officers will provide the court with certain information. And as we've also said in our submission, we do believe that it is appropriate that the so-called onus does shift onto the state to make application, that it shouldn't be automatic inclusion barring the opportunity for the defence to make submissions. I think it should be the responsibility of the state to make application to include the child. And this process would automatically allow for the defence to bring evidence before the board as to countering the NPA or the prosecution of presenting evidence why the child should be on the register. But I don't think, I'm very concerned that it is going to cause the same problems as criminal capacity now has.
Wouldn't you actually think that it might actually work out easier? You've got to assess criminal capacity and leave it in the hands of the state, which would actually go back to the possibility of utilizing probation officers, like in prison and field reports. And probation officers are mostly social workers, and social workers have done psychology. And what is actually also maybe better with social workers, a better place also to do further assessment that would go into general life condition. They, unlike psychologists, they manage to actually do intensive investigation, even visiting this whole child's home, school, and everything. So that kind of assessment would be broader. Actually, it wouldn't just be an assessment, like a desktop assessment of a child. But what is most important is if you take that route, you leave the responsibility in the hands of the state rather than have to go and hire people who are independent workers to come into the assessment, because you're actually worried about the implications. And I think it will be better taken care of if you leave it in the hands of the state. Maybe let's get comments from members to hear their views. Honorable Horn?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think the one thing I wanted to say is I concur with perfect. Is that definitely the issue of will there be a re-offending should not be the only criteria. Then secondly, I support the proposal regarding probation officers. To the best of my knowledge, probation officers in any event, it is within their authority to make use of psychological reports as well. So they do not do, if they are maybe challenged, to make up their minds that they are allowed to also make this a psychologist, so they, in my view, are quite well placed to do this job on behalf of the state. Thank you.
Ms. Roberts, did you want to say something?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to clarify something which may have been misunderstood by my colleague, Mr. Bassett. Do you aid intensive report? Is the NPA bring an application for the person, for the child's name to go on the sexual offence register? They will obviously get the reports to show certain things, the reports which we are discussing now. We, as legal aid, who will defend the accused person or the accused child, will obviously then bring our own expert report. But it doesn't mean that legal aid is going to pay for the report or contribute to the report. Where the NPA brings that application, we will get our own report to our own experts. I think I need to clarify that because a misimpression may have been created. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Advocate Passage, I will call you a seat. Alright, yes. Did you want to say something, Advocate Tether?
Sorry, if there was something that you wanted to respond to me in terms of, wanted me to respond to in terms of your comments, just that I agree with what you're saying, is that it should be the responsibility of the state to carry the costs of that evaluation and that, or that assessment. And I think practically what could happen is that pre-sentence reports are done for most offenders, whether they're adults, children, etc. And part of that pre-sentence report can be a request to come from the state to indicate at conviction that the state will bring an application to place a child on the register and to request probation officers to consider that particular issue when doing their pre-sentence report.
Thank you very much. Do we still have comments from members? Can we proceed? Honorable Bongo?
Yes. Chair, that's your request to the department about the legislature really look into the issue of the criteria. I think when we come back to teen rapes, you know, let's get more, because that criteria is, I think it's been hard to, you can't say a person, you can determine whether he will, because we are not even sure, not even a psychologist, so you can only give probabilities on the basis of that. But let's look at other ones. So I think we do have precedence of what we can use on the 200.
Thank you. Can we go speak?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That brings us to around about page 60 of the summary. Madam Chair, the remainder of the issues raised are, some of them are of a technical nature, most of them are repeated, but those are, I think, issues that will naturally come up during the deliberations of the committee on the bill. So I'm not really going to highlight anything for you. I think those responses by the department also speak for themselves. But I would like you possibly, if you would allow me, to conclude. And I know that it is somewhere in the summary that we addressed, but I just couldn't find it. But there was a young man at the public hearings of the committee who made a recommendation that the short title of the act should be amended. He complained that it is really too long to remember. And we would like to specifically maybe just highlight our response to that young man by saying that we should take into consideration there are a number of reasons why the short title of the act is as it is, because first of all, the 1957 Sexual Offences Act is still in force, firstly. Secondly, that the 2007 Act not only deals with sexual offences exclusively, but it also deals with other related matters, for example, compulsory HIV testing, and then also the National Register for Sex Offenders. And then finally, the third reason that we would like to give to that young man is that, unfortunately, the Act was promulgated in 2007, so it's been in force for a very long time. We will, unfortunately, at this stage, possibly even after any repeal of the 57 Act, have to remain with the current short title of the Act. But possibly just to recommend to him that if he in the future wants to refer to this, he can merely refer to it as the 2007 Sexual Offenders Act, and everyone will know what he is referring to. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, was he complaining about the short title or long title?
No, the short title, Madam Chair. You remember Mona Songolo, the young man who was here, who said that the short title of the act is too long for him. He cannot remember it. And that's our response. So that you just know that there's a specific reason why we unfortunately have such a long short title.
Thank you, Honourable Advocate Dupree. Do we have any comments from members?
Just one quick question. Mm-hmm. Would you just look at why can't you call this bill the further amendment bill? Because you've got Amendment Act, Amendment Bill, I understand why, but why can't you take out the Amendment Act and just say further amendment act? For when it's possible. Maybe look at that, you don't have to answer now.
You can answer immediately. Yeah. What will we call the amendment after that to service?
The second further.
Advocate the fifth.
Thank you, Chair. Just one last issue, and that's on page 70 of your document. And this deals with the removal of a child's name from the register. There was support for that, for the amendments in general, but this is a departmental proposal for the committee's consideration. It's technical in nature, and no NGO or anybody has raised it. And we say it should be noted that the ambit of the proposed new subsection 2A, and that is in clause 8. We're dealing with clause 8. And the proposed new subsection 2A is limited to those cases where the court has, after implementation of the 2007 Act, made an order for inclusion of particulars of a person in the register. So our provision in the bill does not cater for those historic cases where the particulars of a person are placed on the register who were convicted before the commencement of the 2007 Act, before the commencement of the 2007 Act, and those persons committed sexual offences against children or mentally disabled people. So the department is proposing, it's a technical amendment again, of the proposed new Section 2A, which in Clause 8 of the bill, to cater not only for cases where the offence was committed after the implementation of UP 2007 Act, but also for similar offences that were committed prior to the implementation of the 2007 Act. So it really is just technical, but to make sure that children that commit those offences in the past can also enjoy the benefits of having their names removed from the register.
Thank you, Honourable President. Honourable Bongo, does it cover retrospectivity that you are concerned about?
Right, it's fine. So we'll engage when we deliberate. But we should thank them for the good job that we think. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I guess then that concludes the business. Let me refer you back to the chair so that you can round off the session.
Just to say that we note this internal workshops by the department, but we don't want you to finalize the workshops, come back to us, and then we say to you the workshops were not representative. So I think it would be advisable maybe that you share with us in these workshops who are the people that you invite, offer us an opportunity if we think there are other stakeholders that you have left out, that we may make suggestions, because otherwise we'll wait in your time and our time unless that is done. But otherwise, NPA, we must thank you very much for very useful contributions, because these days when people hear the word NPA, they want to make other suggestions which are not justified as far as we're concerned. So it was good having you here for 2 days. And then Legal Aid, our old friends, and they always don't disappoint us. Mr. Bassett is part of the furniture in Parliament. If we don't see him for a few hours, we get worried. But otherwise, all those people at the back who chose to be backbenchers are very valuable to us, and we appreciate your interest in these matters before us, because we need your wisdom, we need your contributions, and continue supporting us. I see Mr. Mutetwa has been with us also from yesterday and before, and you will see that matters that arise here are very much relevant to the work that you are doing. I hope that you have enough good work, homework from here. And don't hesitate to communicate with us if anything, you want to raise anything. Our doors are open for you all the time. Members of the media, you have actually been communicating very well, not distorting anything. And we managed to get the broader public interested in the debates that are here. And we appreciate that very much, and we want to urge you to continue the good work you are actually taking this Parliament to the people, and thank you very much. And honorable members, thank you very much for your participation. And have a good lunch, although I don't know where you are going to have lunch, all of you, but wherever you have it, have a good lunch. Thank you.